hello and welcome to an incredibly special Archaeology News Weekly. I am, of course, your host, David Connolly. Now, this news, of course, is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. Right, well now, what an exciting day this is. The 200th episode of Archaeo News. It only goes for me to say a huge thank you to you, from us, for helping us get this far. We've had loads of well-wishers sending us in emails, and I will attempt to mention as many as I possibly can during this specially extended programme. There's a lot of specials here. And indeed, let's go over to our outside broadcast unit right now in our live audience, where we have a treat in store. A piece of music created specially, yes, specially, for this remarkable day.
The Band of Her Majesty's Royal Marines, Portsmouth.
Yeah, okay, so really, do you think we're made of money? Let's start more realistically with a message from Diego and Paula from Stone Pages and also a couple of emails. This is the message from Diego. It's, working on podcasts is like throwing a message in a bottle of a giant mysterious ocean. We often get very little feedback, but we are determined to go on producing our archaeology news. Thank you, Diego. With the hope that spreading the knowledge about ancient civilizations and sites will prevent them from disappearing into the sands of time or indifference. If we should make a dedication for this special issue, it's a thanks to our fellow travellers. Oh, thank you. It's to myself and David Horrocks. And of course, there's a special thank you to the small, enthusiastic group of friends and volunteers that over the years have helped us gather and edit all the news that you listen to each week. Without them, this podcast would not exist. And thanks to their help, encouragement and dedication, we have now managed to throw our message number 200 into that bottle of the net. Anyway, in the hope of continuing this fantastic adventure, let's all work together to the 1,000th issue. Good grief, just how old do you think I'm going to get to there, Diego? Well, thanks for that. But actually, I have to say, without you and Paula, there would be no news at all. So hats off to you. Now to Giovanna Fregni, who tells us that the podcast has been part of her life for years. Indeed, before she came to Sheffield in the UK, she would ride a bus to work back in Minnesota and listen to our podcast. Thank you so much for living both the way that I can't help but add a bit of commentary and humour in there. She also mentions, actually, that the podcast might have had a subtle influence on her choice of postgrad studies, and she's now celebrating 3 years of living in Britain. Well, I salute you. Thank you for that. And one more before we start, going to Al Greer, who writes that the podcast has inspired him to go on two fantastic adventures. One is a trip to Cresswell Crags to see cave art, and the other is taking his dad to the often featured Stonehenge for his 70th birthday. Well, thank you very much, Al, and of course, thanks to your dad as well. I hope he enjoyed his trip. Now, without much further ado, but of course with much interruption, let's get on with the Archaeology News Weekly, Podcast 200. There's a bit of a Welsh flavour to this week's podcast. We've got new discoveries at the Trefail Stone in Wales. Then we've got Bronze Age finds under the Llangollen Pillar, guess where, in Wales. We then move to Asia, though, where it seems it was settled in multiple waves of migration. We've got excavations around the islands of Britain, which are establishing Neolithic origins, and a standing stone in Derbyshire, which may have been a seasonal sundial. To Malta next, where the Gigantia temples are getting a massive makeover.
And then to Australia, where it seems that genetic study of Aboriginal Australians shows more about migration out of Africa. English Heritage unveil a new high-resolution 3D model of, oh yes, Stonehenge. And then we talk about the girl from Lozoya Valley. A fascinating story, that one. An early understanding of tides. Well, this is part two, listening for that. And then, very gruesome I'm afraid, ancient human skulls mounted on stakes are found in a lake in Sweden. Then to Portugal, where a stone has been found with 1,200 prehistoric engravings on it, up from the 40 that were originally recognised. Then we've got 9,000-year-old multiple burials uncovered in Corsica, and finish with, yes, back to Wales, with Neolithic finds at a Welsh quarry. Remember, of course, you can listen to all of this on Stone Pages Archaeo News app, as well as keeping up with the latest news as it happens. So let's get going. The second excavation season at the Trefail Stone in southwest Wales has just finished, and the results are very interesting indeed. Last year, a team of archaeologists led by Dr. George Nash and my lovely friends, well, of course, George is my friend as well, Adam Stanford and Tom Wellicombe, hello all of you, uncovered the probable remains of a portal dolmen, one of Western Britain's oldest monument types. The excavation revealed a significant cairn deposit that was first identified through geophysical survey. In addition to this tightly compacted cairn material, a clear Neolithic surface was exposed. Artifacts were limited to a few shards of later pottery, but found within the cairn deposits were two perforated shale beads of possible Mesolithic date. The presence of such artifacts reflects the importance of the site several thousand years before the portal dolmen was constructed. What's more, the Trefail Stone appears to have formed the capstone for a portal dolmen, and this was probably reused as a standing stone during the earlier Middle Bronze Age. During the 2011 season, a geophysics team geoprospected a sector in which a number of clear anomalies were detected. Two such areas were located a few metres to the north and west of the monument and were subsequently excavated by the Welsh Rock Art Organisation. Uncovered in a trench immediately west of the Trefail Stone were several shards of Neolithic pottery, probably grooved ware, along with human bone. This material, along with a few pieces of flint, appears to have been dispersed amongst probable disturbed ploughed-out cairn material. Discovered within the second trench, though, was a stone linear alignment, originally thought to be a prehistoric field boundary. But further excavation, supervised by archaeologist Kat Rees, revealed, this is one for, I seem to know everybody in this story, hello Kat as well, revealed this curious feature to be part of a burial kist, probable Bronze Age in date. Directly associated with the feature was a large quantity of charcoal. Now, this is a bit of an in-joke, but we do love our charcoal, don't we? In addition to the excavation programme, geophysical survey also revealed in a field to the south and east of the monument further anomalies, suggesting that the Trefail Monument is not alone and was in fact part of a much larger ritual landscape. Evidence is further endorsed by the excavation from a nearby hedge boundary of a missing standing stone, which disappeared some 30 years ago. How exactly do you lose a standing stone? I'm going to have to contact them about this one. This single monolith, which once stood in the adjacent field, measures 2 metres in length. Work to record 75 cut marks on the Trefail Stone was completed by the team at the 11th hour, before they retired to the pub, I bet you. Initial reports suggest that cut marks numbered only 40 in the 2012 season. However, the team hopes to continue the investigation within the two trenches and also undertake further trenching in and around the immediate area. Now, staying in Wales, remains dating back to the Bronze Age have been uncovered by archaeologists excavating a 9th century monument, the Pillar of Elseg, near Llangollen, Denbighshire in Wales. Possible cremated remains and prehistoric bone fragments are now being examined. The experts said the finds had complicated the picture regarding the site's significance and makes it worthy of further investigation. Bangor and Chester University archaeologists and students have been involved in a dig with the Welsh Monument Agency CADU to conserve and better understand the mound. Last year's excavations focused on the mound itself, which was identified as an early Bronze Age cairn. It said that local landowner Trevor Lloyd re-erected the monument on the mound in 1773 after it fell over and found a grave with a body inside with a piece of silver. The experts have been trying to find out if there's any truth to the story, which some think is a legend. Professor Nancy Edwards from Bangor University said to establish any truth in the story, they had to clear away debris left by Lloyd more than 200 years ago. They cleared this out to reveal what they think are Bronze Age remains underneath, but they've also have what they think now is an early medieval long kiss grave, so it's looking even more complicated now, and there's even some evidence of Bronze Age cremations. The pillar of El Seg was originally a tall stone cross, but only part of a round shaft survives set within its original base. It once bore a long Latin inscription saying that the cross was raised by Conten, ruler of the kingdom of Powys, who died 854 CE, in memory of his great-grandfather El Seg, who'd driven Anglo-Saxon invaders out of the area. I have to say that they actually have a lovely website and a YouTube channel, so you can follow the whole project from start to finish online. If you want to have a look at that, well, you want me to tell you what the website is, don't you? It's www.projectelseg.org. That was project, and it's all one word, ELISEG.org. Get along there and have a look at what they've been up to. Now, Asia. An international team of researchers studying DNA patterns from modern and archaic humans have uncovered new clues about the movement intermixing of populations in Asia more than 40,000 years ago. Scientists from Harvard Medical School and Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig found that Denisovans, a recently identified group of archaic humans whose DNA was extracted only last year from a finger bone excavated in Siberia, I kid you not, contributed DNA not just to present-day New Guineans, but also to Aboriginal, Australian and Philippine populations. According to David Reich, professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School, Denisova DNA is so recognisable that you can detect even a little bit of it in one individual. This shows the power of sequencing ancient DNA as a tool for understanding human history. The patterns the researchers found can only be explained by at least two waves of human migration. The first giving rise to the Aboriginal populations that currently live in Southeast Asia and Oceania, and later migrations giving rise to relatives of East Asians who are now the primary population of Southeast Asia. According to Mark Stoneking, professor of Max Planck Institute and senior author of the paper, Denisovans must have inhabited an extraordinarily large ecological and geographic range, all the way from Siberia to tropical Southeast Asia. I hope they packed their sun cream there. The fact that Denisovan's DNA is present in some Aboriginal populations of Southeast Asia but not in others can most easily be explained if Denisovans lived in Southeast Asia itself. Denisovans were a distinct group of archaic humans that lived more than 30,000 years ago and contributed genes to present-day New Guineans. Denisovans were neither Neanderthals nor early modern humans, though they both shared a common ancestry. The paper helps fill in some pieces in the evolutionary puzzle that began after early humans left Africa and reinforces the view that humans have intermixed throughout history. What a lovely way of saying what I think they're trying to say. The researchers conclude that Denisovans interbred with modern humans in Southeast Asia at least 44,000 years ago, before the time of the separation of the Australians and New Guineans, and that Southeast Asia was first colonised by modern humans unrelated to the present-day Chinese and Indonesians, that these and other East Asians arrived in later migrations. Well, let's have a little break from the news and add a couple more dedications and perhaps a blooper or two. Why not? Well, this one's from Gelly in Australia, who thanks us all for a wonderful podcast. Their words, not mine. They say that they listen to each one and enjoy them immensely, especially how we always manage to put a bit of humour in there. Way to go. I look forward to many more. Well, thank you very much, Gelly. And also to William in Santa Barbara, who I know always keeps a close ear on proceedings. Now, I promise you some bloopers, so here are a couple to start you off. On the new study, the researchers integrate what is currently known about early maize in the southwest with genetic, paleoecological, ecological. That's one for the bloopers. There's a black mat layer across North America, which is correlated to the younger Dryas climatic shift seen in Greenland ice cores.
Ahem. Right, well, back to the news there. You can see I just can't get everything right all the time. Perfection. You want perfection? I don't know. Let's return to, of course, the news, where we've got archaeologists at Liverpool University investigating three island groups around Britain to further understand why, in approximately 4000 BCE, humans changed from hunting and gathering to agriculture. Some scholars believe that this occurred due to colonists from the continent bringing farming and pottery-making skills with them, but others argue that the indigenous population adopted this new lifestyle gradually on their own. Study has shown that the first colonists are likely to have arrived across the western seaways, but there's been very little excavation of the islands around the sea routes. Dr. Duncan Garrow from the University School of Archaeology, Classics and Egyptology explains that Neolithic is a term used for the period in our past when the shift from hunting and gathering wild animals and plants to farming lifestyle occurred. This change happened at different times throughout the world, beginning around 10,000 BCE in the Middle East and around 4,000 BCE in Britain. How this process occurred, however, is still very much debated. They will be excavating on the Channel Islands, the Isles of Scilly and the Outer Hebrides, which form part of an important maritime zone that surprisingly has been given little scholarly attention in the past. The intention is to construct a database of all known 5th and 4th millennium occupation sites in and around each island group and start a programme of radiocarbon dating to understand the chronology of activity within the Western Seaways. Oceanographic work aims to explore the environmental context within which this transition took place. I nearly had another blooper there by accident. And how seafaring activities impacted on people's lifestyles. They hope that the environmental data will also be valuable to oceanographers and geographers now for studying how the sea has been changing over the centuries. The team will also make their findings available to school children and to us, the general public, through the development of a series of web resources, including, I can't wait for this one, a navigation game based upon prehistoric seafaring. Now, a standing stone in Derbyshire. A standing stone at the popular tourist site of Gardam's Edge in the Derbyshire Peak District in England may in fact be a 4,000-year-old seasonal sundial. Academics in astronomy and landscape history at Nottingham Trent University will soon present their findings from a study of the site at the European Society of Astronomy in Culture Conference, that's in Portugal. The project involves surveying and analysing the orientation of a single standing stone, which is linked to a nearby prehistoric monument, including its deterioration through erosion. The experts have been able to make the prediction based on the stone's orientation, the dip of its slope, and the altitude of the sun at midsummer. It's thought that late Neolithic people may have used the illumination of the slanted side of the 2.2-metre high stone as a marker for seasons and, crucially, seasonal migration, which was so important for them at the time. Single standing stones are quite rare in the Peak District, and the possible use as a seasonal sundial would be unique within the British Isles. University's Dr. Daniel Brown said, "We know that the people here moved from summer pastures on higher hills to winter retreats located in the valleys. This single standing stone gives us an idea about how they perceived the skies and how the ancient monument and the landscape reflected it." So basically, if it was half past solstice, it was time to get down. Now, in Malta, the Gigantea temples are the most popular heritage site in Malta, and a lot of work has gone into restoring their structural integrity. The site now offers an enhanced visitor experience thanks to direct investment of €200,000 by the Vodafone Malta Foundation. The new project incorporates two new lightweight walkways which will now take visitors straight into the heart of the temple. The project also includes an interactive digital and virtual tour of Gigantea. The temples have been fitted with an environmental monitoring station which measures exposure to environmental elements, and the site has also been made safer with the installation of a remote security system. Not exactly what they're protecting against. And we've got sort of ghosts from the past still going around. Anyway, in the first 4 months of 2011, Gigantea had the highest visitor numbers for all of Heritage Malta sites, amounting to, wait for it, 44,436 people. Thanks to the construction of two walkways inside Gigantea, visitors will have full access to the temples. This structure protects the original prehistoric floors while providing visitors with better visibility.
Another element which will further enhance the visitor's experience is the Vodafone Gigantia Interactive DVD-ROM, which is a digitised version of the site with impressive 360-degree photography, along with detailed descriptions of each of the areas of this UNESCO World Heritage Site. The temples were erected around about 3,500 BCE and are reputed to be among the first, first freestanding structures in the world. It survived extraordinarily well, with walls and places still standing to a height of 7 metres. There are two adjacent temples, the southern one on the left having had part of its wall removed to allow the northern one to be built up against it. I have to say, I have been there. It was most enjoyable. There are quite a few lovely sights in Malta. My only hint to make it even better is signage. The number of times I drove around Malta desperately trying to find some of these sites. Anyway, enough of my bugbear. Just put better signs in. Now, sites like this are a nightmare for me sometimes to pronounce properly. And over the years, I've had many, many emails correcting my the way I actually say things. Anyway, here are a couple of fine examples of me sticking my foot into my geolocational mouth.
Andharas flourished before the advent of the Satavaharanas. I knew I was going to have trouble with this one. Which attempts to retrace the genuine migration route of the ancient Austronesians. Is there such a word?
Ah, me. Well, we do try and we do appreciate it when you tell us where we go horribly, horribly wrong. Anyway, let's see if I can get through this next one without making any terrible mistakes. It's a 90-year-old tuft of hair which has yielded the first complete genome of an Aboriginal Australian, a young man who lived in southwest Australia. He and perhaps all Aboriginal Australians, the genome indicates, descended from the first humans to venture far beyond Africa more than 60,000 years ago, at least 24,000 years before the population movements that gave rise to the present-day Europeans and Asians. Eske Willerslev, a paleogeneticist at the University of Copenhagen, Denmark, who led the study, calls the Aboriginal Australian descendants the first human explorers. The most comprehensive genetic analysis carried out so far pointed to a single migration that spawned all Asian populations, including Aboriginal Australians. But estimated times of the separation of European and Asian ancestors in the population did not fit well with the archaeological evidence for the continuous settlement of Australia from much earlier times. A complete genome from an ancient Aboriginal Australian would settle this debate. About a year ago, though, his team obtained a hair sample originally collected by the British ethnologist Alfred Court Haddon, taken back in the 1920s. An analysis of the genome of this sample indicates that his ancestors started their journey more than 60,000 years ago, branching off from humans who left Africa. The ancestors of contemporary Europeans and most other Asians probably went their separate ways less than 40,000 years ago. Like other populations outside Africa, the Australian Aboriginal man owes small chunks of his genome to Neanderthals. More surprisingly, though, his ancestors also interbred with another archaic human population known as, and we've talked about this in a previous story, the Denisovans. This group was identified from 30 to 50,000-year-old DNA recovered from the finger bone in Siberia. Just check to see if you were listening to the previous report. A second study incorporating genomic surveys from different Aboriginal Australians paints an even clearer picture of the ancestors' exploits with the Denisovans. Researchers led by Mark Stonking at the Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Anthropology calculated the portion of Denisovan ancestry found in the genomes of 243 people, representing 33 Asian and Oceanic populations. Patterns of Denisovan interbreeding in human populations could reveal human migration routes through Asia. This comparison reveals a patchwork in which some populations, including the Australian Aboriginals, bore varying levels of Denisovan DNA, while many of their neighbours, like the residents of mainland Southeast Asia, contained none. Stonking says that this pattern hints at least two waves of human migration into Asia, an early trek that included the ancestors of contemporary Aboriginal Australians followed by a second wave that gave rise to the present residents of mainland Asia. However, some members of the first wave, no, not all of them, interbred with Denisovans. The Denisovans may have vanished by the time the second Asian migrants arrived, though. This also suggests that the Denisovan range once extended, as we said before, all the way to Southeast Asia and perhaps even into Oceania. Put together, these two papers make an overwhelming case for multiple waves of migration, and that the peopling of Australia is going to be even more complicated than possibly even these papers suggest. Well, here it is. It would not be the archaeology news without Stonehenge Story of the Week. A detailed survey of every stone that makes up Stonehenge using the latest technology, including a new scanner that's never been used before in a heritage project in Britain, has resulted in the most accurate digital model of the world-famous monument. With a resolution level as high as 0.5 millimetres in many areas, every nook and cranny of these blasted stones has been revealed with the utmost clarity, including the lichens, the Bronze Age carvings, the erosion patterns, and the Victorian graffiti. Most surprisingly, initial assessment of the survey has suggested that the grooves resulted from the stone dressing on some of the Starson stones appear to be divided into sections, perhaps with different teams of Neolithic builders working on separate areas. You can actually see a first glimpse of the model on the English Heritage website, though I must admit they keep it well hidden. If I were you, I would Google in 3D Stonehenge model English Heritage. You'll hopefully find it there. In March 2011, English Heritage commissioned 3D laser scanning specialist the Greenhatch Group, together with Atkins Mapping and Archaeo Environmental Limited, to capture the stones and the landscape surrounding them at a level of precision and definition never before attempted. The survey includes all the visible faces of the standing stones and the fallen stones of Stonehenge, including the station, heel and slaughter stones, as well as the tops of the horizontal lintels. The result, high-resolution archive data 3D meshed model, sounds good, doesn't it, is currently being synthesised and will be officially published and shared in due course. I cannot wait. Now, there's a very famous archaeological site near Madrid in Spain known as the Calvario de la Higuera site. Excavations have been carried out there for over 10 years, funded by a €180,000 grant from the Spanish Regional Department of Arts, Education and Environment. The site has proved itself to be one of the richest paleoarchaeological sites in Europe and has yielded more than 3,000 fauna fossils so far. However, a new find has been described as being so important that Vice Premier of the regional government, Ignacio González, has ordered the purchase of more land to expand the excavations. The find is four teeth belonging to a 2.5-year-old girl dated at approximately 40,000 BCE, which places her firmly within a Neanderthal family. The child has been nicknamed the Girl from the Zoya Valley. The leader of the excavation, Enrique Bacuadano, is quoted as saying, "It's an extraordinary discovery because of the enormous quantity of biological and genetic information that the teeth, due to their hardness and survival, will provide." It's hoped that the study of DNA extracted from the teeth will enable the team to ascertain her diet, her vocal ability, and even her brain capacity. Well, there you go. Now, back in August 2011, we commented on some findings from South Africa which showed that early Homo sapiens had developed knowledge of tides to enable him to harvest brown mussels and sea snails, which were only accessible at low tide. As Homo sapiens migrated north into the coastal areas of the Mediterranean, he took the knowledge with him to exploit the seas in these new territories. It could appear now that he either shared this knowledge with local Neanderthals or they copied them or even developed them themselves. Well, that covers all the bases, doesn't it? A team comprising archaeologists from Seville University and the Spanish National Council for Scientific Investigation have been carrying out work in a cave in Torremolinos on Spain's Costa del Sol. Their finds date from approximately 150,000 BCE, and the remains of shellfish and marine animals have been found, similar to those on Pinnacle Point in South Africa. Some of the remains contained burned mussel shells, which suggest that they preferred their shellfish cooked, and there's evidence of tools being used to crack open these shells. The interesting point to note is that this find is contemporaneous with the South African find, which poses the question as to why both Neanderthal and Homo sapiens evolved in quite diverse ways. Then, at one point, they were following the same behavioural pattern. I think it might have been a little summer holiday, actually. The leader of the team from Seville University, Miguel Cortez Sanchez, is quoted as saying, "It provides evidence for the exploitation of coastal resources by Neanderthals at a much earlier time than any of those previously recorded." Now, shall we have some more dedications? I think so. And this is actually a very special one for Michelle. Yes, Michelle, you know who you are. I have to say, you are one fabulous person. And I hope your mother appreciates this little dedication. And I promise to keep my accent exactly as it is, Ochai the New. Now, to another person who enjoys a soft Scottish accent. This one's for Cara Greenlaw. Yes, Cara, your lovely partner, Jeff, sent in this dedication specially for you. He says, over 16 years ago that you met in an archaeological dig. Ah, and now, as landscapers, you still have hands in the dirt. Lovely nickname, by the way. But I don't really think I'm going to say this out loud. Anyway, how can I follow that? We've got some lovely dedications. The best way to follow up some lovely dedications, probably with some heads on a stake. Yes, why not? Several human skulls found mounted on wooden stakes have been uncovered from a Stone Age lake bed in central Sweden, in what is believed to be the first discovery of its kind anywhere in the world. Archaeologist Fredrik Hallgren, head of the excavation with the Cultural Preservation Society of Mälardalen, said the team had found two skulls that still had wooden stakes sticking out through a hole in the base of the skull. The skulls and other artefacts, including bones of wild animals, were recovered at the Kanaljorden excavation site in the town of Motala in central Sweden. According to results from carbon 14 dating, the skulls and other items are estimated to be around 8,000 years old. The mounted skulls were found with the stakes inserted the full length from the base to the top of the skull. In another case, a temporal bone of one individual identified as a female was found placed inside the skull of another woman. Altogether, Hallberg and his colleagues have identified skulls or skull fragments from 11 individuals, including both men and women, ranging from infants to middle-aged. The bones were found in what was a shallow lake during the early Stone Age, which appears to have served as a ceremonial burial site. Clearly, this lake was some sort of holy place for the people who lived there at the time. Two theories may explain why the human skulls were mounted on wooden stakes before being placed in the lake bed. One thought is that they were part of some sort of secondary burial ritual, where the skulls were removed from the dead bodies. After the soft tissue had rotted away, the skulls were then inserted onto a stake before being placed in the shallow lake. Another theory, however, is that the mounted skulls were trophies brought back from battles with other settlers in the area. It may have been one way to prove one's success in the battlefield. Further analysis is currently underway to determine if the bones are remains of locals or people from another location. Archaeologists also try and find out if the remains found at the site belong to a single family group or persons unrelated to each other. For some, we do love stories like this, don't we? But it's this interesting point where we don't really understand the people of the past, what they were thinking, what their beliefs were. It's only by actually looking into these sort of stories very carefully, very forensically, and getting away from the ideas of battles and appalling tortures and that, and actually trying to look deeper about the meanings that they were placing onto why they were doing this, that we're actually going to get a little bit closer to our ancestors. Anyway, I'll wipe a tear from my eye and then continue, where recent archaeological investigations in northern Portugal have uncovered a number of prehistoric sites and artefacts, including rock art and engravings at Laia de Chora in the Serra de Santa Luzia. An archaeologist working for Enardas, which is coordinating the project, said that the flat stone, I'm not actually sure how big this flat stone was, which was discovered about 40 years ago, is today becoming one of the most important artefacts with engravings. We are talking, of course, about a flat stone, of which size I don't know, and it must be quite big because investigation has identified 1,200 engraving motifs when originally only 10 were identified previously. She estimates that the site where the stone was discovered could have been used as a sacred place. from around about 3000 to 4000 BCE. The aim of this new project is to study prehistoric remains from between 5000 to 1000 BCE, making an inventory and studying places with burial rock art and metal deposits. I'm still baffled by the fact that you can go from 10 engravings recognised to 1200. Good on you. Now, into Corsica, the exceptional discovery of burials of 9,000 years ago, probably containing the oldest human remains ever found in Corsica, will allow a better understanding of the human history of early settlement of the island and the Mediterranean. On a hill near the village of Solacaro, southern Corsica, nestled under a huge ball-shaped block of eroded granite, which served as a shelter for these prehistoric people, the location has been excavated by a team of archaeologists from several French universities, assisted by a Danish colleague. It's evidence of human presence on the island during the Mesolithic period from 10,000 to 5,000 BCE, so says Josep Kaisare, regional curator of archaeological and historical monuments. Having uncovered the bones of four or five adults, a teenager and a baby spread over an area of a few square metres, I think the bones, not the baby, on the site of Campo Stefano during the past several months, efforts in recent weeks have revealed the almost complete skeleton of another adult. Patrice Courtaud, paleontologist and researcher at CNRS and a specialist in Bordeaux Mesolithic burial practices, said there are very few multiple burials, particularly in Corsica, adding, "We still know very little about the people of the Mesolithic, a period marking the beginning of agricultural settlement. If researchers can extract DNA from bones, this will help to further our knowledge of genetics, nutrition, and lifestyle in general. Evidence of human life in Corsica during the Mesolithic has been uncovered previously, including the discovery in 1973 of the Lady of Bonifacio. The entire skeleton of this woman is now exhibited at the Museum Levi in southern Corsica. The date of her burial is estimated around about 6,500 BCE. Another individual burial was also discovered in the Cap Corse region. The first bones removed at Campo Stefano, well preserved despite the highly acidic granitic soils, have been carbon dated to between 7,400 to 6,800 BCE. The remains will of course be subject to extensive studies at various laboratories, including the University of Bordeaux. Now, fragments of Neolithic pottery and an ancient arrowhead represented the best finds yet from a dig at a quarry near Wrexham in Wales. The discovery of the remains of 4,000-year-old Neolithic settlement at Tarmac's Boras Quarry was announced 3 years ago. Evidence of the settlement was found as topsoil and subsoil was being removed in preparation for gravel extraction. Clwyd Powys Archaeological Trust has been excavating at the site since 2008. The Trust said that about 500 pieces of pottery and flint artefacts dating back to 3,500 BCE had been uncovered during the summer digs at four sites. Ian Grant, CPAT's site director, hailed it as the best site and season he has ever had. Well, there is a man who is happy in their work. Well done to you. Now, we'll finish off this special edition of the news with a couple more dedications, and I personally love this one. It's from Ben and Helen Cooper from New Hampshire in USA, who enjoy our podcast and both have the app on their iPods. Top people. They also seem to love the bloopers, so I've put in some nice ones for you this episode. I hope you enjoyed them. I'll put in another one for you right after this dedication. Their dedication was, I nearly forgot there, it is, how could I forget? It's to say hello to Ben, Helen and little Ben from New Hampshire. Thank you so much for listening. And I do hope that little Ben becomes an Indiana Jones when he grows up. Now to Geneva from Fort Wayne in Indiana, the message is thank you for providing this podcast. I do like the fact that almost everyone likes my sideways and sometimes humorous take on stories. So thank you for that. The kindest compliment is that when you're starting an especially tedious project, you turn on our podcast to keep you going. So thank you so, so much for that. It really does help keep us going. And I would love to have read out all the dedications and messages of goodwill that we got, but I should just like to thank you all who may emailed us in. So let's just throw out a few more. I'd like to say thank you to John, to Gary, to George, to Sam, to Frank, to Janet, another one to John, to Alison, to Saul, to Stuart, to Aris, Liz, and to many, many more. Thank you all for supporting us. Now, did I promise you another blooper? Well, here it is. Keep your volume turned down low. Project leaders want farmers, ramblers and others to enjoy the who enjoy the countryside to carry a police telephone number with them or even store it on their mobile phone. Yes, that is known as the joys of the countryside as I get buzzed by a large military jet. Thank you very much. Happens more frequently than I like to say. Anyway, before I go, I actually found the original emails between Diego and myself dated way back in June 2005. So here I've going. It's, hey Diego, my main news for contacting you is a suggestion. I'd very much like to create an audio news. What about once a week? My suggestion is that I read out the Stone Pages news. So he answers, with much preamble, of course. We think it's a great idea. We couldn't do it by ourselves because we aren't native English speakers. Well, I hardly am sometimes as well. So if we want to go ahead, we could start a strong collaboration. Episode one was then produced forthwith. Later on, actually, the fabulous Dave Horrocks got involved as well and was able to turn our early attempts, beautifully mastering it. So it's a massive thanks to Dave Horrocks across there in Canada. Hello, can you hear me there, Dave? Thank you again. Anyway, episode one was duly produced with originally two news readers, myself and a mysterious lady. The first email back about the new podcast was that they loved it, but the accent of my friend was probably, how should I put this, a little bit too Scottish, or was it Irish for the average listener? Anyway, it's better that your own English accent continues. I hope your friend does not get offended by any of that. Absolutely perfect. How could I possibly be offended by being told that I've got an English accent and that my friend accent was a little bit too Scottish or Irish? Because that was no friend. Yes, that was my wife. However, I let him off for that one. And I also know that many of you do like my softer Scottish accent. And so, to finish off, here's a wee bit of a Scottish poem to us, and it's sort of it's fairly apt for what we do. Here's to us, wha's like us, damned few, and they're all deed. Mair's the pity. Ah, bless. It only goes for me to say thank you so much for bearing with us, for listening to Podcast 200. It's been absolutely brilliant fun doing, and we hope you'll keep listening until we get to Podcast 300, 400, 500 and beyond. Thank you and good night.